This audio file comes from the Libri Ideas Library at www.libri-ideas-library.org. The library contains over 1,000 lectures and discussions which explore questions about the reality and relevance of Christianity. We ask you to respect the copyright for this audio file, which belongs to Libri Fellowship. The file is for personal use to share with friends, family and colleagues, but please do not publish the material in any format or post it on a website without seeking permission from Libri Fellowship. Please note that views expressed in the lecture and discussion time do not necessarily represent the views of Libri Fellowship.
Tonight we're going to talk about stories, about literature. And I don't know if a Friday night lecture is ever opened with a quiz, but tonight is going to. First line quiz. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was a season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. We had everything before us. We had nothing before us. Very good, Tale of Two Cities. Once, there were four children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy. This story is about something that happened to them when they were sent away from London during the war because of the air raids. They were sent to the house of an old professor. The Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe, of course. The sun did not shine. It was too wet to play. So he sat in the house all that cold, cold, wet day. And then something went bump. How that bump made us jump. Anybody know? The Cat in the Hat, that's right. This is a trickier one. Put on your thinking caps. Once upon a time, in a far-off country, there lived a merchant who had been so fortunate in all his undertakings that he was enormously rich. As he had six sons and six daughters, however, who were accustomed to having everything they fancied, he did not find that he had a penny too much. But misfortunes befell them. What? No. The youngest, that's a good guess, though. There were six sons, 12 something. The youngest was a daughter. Her name was Beauty. Beauty and the Beast. It's the one from the early 1800s, so instead of being an only child, there's, you know, a dozen. On the outskirts of a tiny little town was a neglected garden. In the garden stood an old house, and then in that house lived the main character. She was 9 years old, and she lived there all alone. She had no mother or father, which was actually quite nice, because it meant that no one could tell her she had to go to bed just when she was having the most fun. Any ideas? Pippi Longstocking, very good. Be quick on this one. Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4, Privet Drive, were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much. They were the last people you'd expect to be involved in anything strange or mysterious because they didn't hold with such nonsense. Harry Potter, the Philosopher's Stone. One more. Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits, and their names were Foxy, Mopsy, Cottontail, and Peter. Very good. You all did very well. Opening lines are our invitation in to a book. Books are an invitation into a relationship. As I read these words, I saw some of you jump in recognition. I love that story. I remember. What do you remember? Perhaps you pictured a place, a scene, a time that you had that read to you, a time that you had read it. Perhaps you pictured that university course that almost did you in. Perhaps you felt left out because none of these books are actually the friends of yours. I'm sorry that the ones that I chose are so clearly mainly English and American, with one Scandinavian author thrown in for fun. I would love for you to introduce me to the best authors in Brazil, the best short story writer in Eastern Europe, the best Scandinavian children's author. Oh, but I did get her. When you've read a book, and I have read a book, we have something to share, perhaps something to argue about, something over which we can relate. I called this lecture In Pursuit of Goodness, Beauty, and Truth. Why should we read aloud? I want to touch on that ancient triad, goodness, beauty, and truth, that gives meaning and direction to the existence of every human being and can also help to give some framework to this discussion. As a parent of 5 young children, one who is not even talking yet and one who is on the verge of becoming a teenager, I care deeply about the pursuit of goodness, beauty, and truth. I long to foster in my children and in my children's friends, in my nieces and nephews, a true sense of goodness, a taste for beauty, a hunger for truth. As I look around those who come here to Libri, as I look at my friends and my acquaintances, at those who are living day to day in a world full of choices, full of conflicting opinions, full of contradictory messages about what is good, what is true, and what is beautiful. There is a lot of confusion in our culture today around these pillars of goodness, beauty, and truth. All we need to do is read the news, look at the advertising, watch the TV shows, watch the movies. It's difficult. It's fraught. Goodness, the first one of the they're all sort of equal, not necessarily first, but the first one I'll talk about, the goodness, which is that higher cause which we serve, described by things like honor, justice, and virtue. Goodness feels tired. It's often perceived in certain lights as being old-fashioned, boring, oppressive, small-minded, intolerant, moralistic. But our culture is very moralistic. Our virtue is now found in tolerance. Justice is pursued by advocating our personal rights. G.K. Chesterton said, "God is not a symbol of goodness. Goodness is a symbol of God." Often, though, our view of God is very small, and without the overarching framework, we don't know what we mean when we talk about goodness. Our categories have become confused, fragmented. Our consciences are dulled. If you want it, go for it. Whatever works for you. I have a right to be. Then the category of truth. Truth is that which describes the world the way it is, and that which describes us the way that we are. But truthfulness as a category is also under attack. What is true for me is not necessarily true for you. We are so stuck in introspection that we can't move into the world of ideas very easily. Francis Schaeffer stressed how unsatisfactory this hold on truth is. He said, in numerous places, things like this, but this is one quote. "When I say that Christianity is true, I mean that it is true to the total reality, the total of what is, beginning with the central reality, the objective existence of the personal finite God. Christianity is not just a series of truths, but truth, truth about all of reality." When that overarching framework is challenged, and when we lose confidence in true truth, we are very susceptible to a purely relativistic and pragmatic view of truth. And beauty, the other of the pillars. The appetite for beauty is deeply inscribed in every human heart, and the whisper and faint hint of longing for beauty is a powerful motivation to each one of us. But if our concept of beauty is not tied in and enhanced by a true understanding of truth and goodness, we will find, again, our categories for the pursuit of beauty to be imploding. What does it mean to be beautiful? So often, it's about projecting an image. So often, it means hiding. There is much cynicism around the concept of beauty. And while beauty should be the gift of a symbol that causes us to look at the world around us and respond truly to beauty by awakening life, wonder, hope, so often we are trained to deconstruct beauty into something that becomes quite flimsy, definable, and it loses some of its magic and some of its hope. Andrew Fellows, who worked here at Libri for 20 years, has a great lecture called Recovering Beauty, Goodness, and Truth. It's here in our library. It's on the Libri Ideas website for a free download. In it, he mentions with Andrew-like passion, he speaks with Andrew-like passion about the huge need to point people to Jesus Christ. Only in knowing Christ and following Him can we recover the true sense of these very important things. Goodness, beauty, and truth are incarnated in Him. But Andrew goes further. He says to focus on beauty. He says, the loss of truth and goodness as larger realities is so endemic. The resistance to truth and goodness is enormous, but beauty, he says, this tender shoot has a strange ability to work through the hardness and indifference of our culture. The lecture is worth a listen. Beauty, so unpredictable, so unexpected, a whiff of something that causes us to catch our breath, brings a lump to our throats, awakens longing. And I would add that stories are a powerful means to tiptoe back to a confidence in these categories of goodness, beauty, and truth, and to grow to love and long for God, our Maker, our Creator, our Father. Stories have a way of bringing to beauty to light, or of showing ugliness in such a way that we ache for resolution and harmony and beauty. Stories cause us to cry out, no, when we should be responding with a no. And stories cause us to whisper, yes, when we see true justice being done. Stories can bring a lump to our throats when we see and respond to brokenness and can awaken the hero within, when we see courage being demonstrated in a character who is not actually that different from who we are. So why should we read aloud? The question that is being asked tonight. Because we need help. We can't do this alone. Our children shouldn't be left to negotiate these categories on their own. We need each other. We need good books, living books, books that are about exploring reality, whether they're science fiction, children's picture books, Victorian novels, graphic novels, fantasy, whatever the genre, books can help us to develop a common language for shared life and exploring themes together. I grew up in a family that read aloud. Neither of my parents grew up in homes that had many books. They certainly didn't read aloud together. The classic children's books, the biographies, nonfiction, history, and as we got older, literature of all sorts were read out loud, enjoyed, engaged with together. And my parents were deeply impacted by Francis and Edith Schaeffer and their emphasis on the lordship of Christ over all of life. I have a picture of my parents on their honeymoon, sitting on a couch in front of a fire in their new apartment, because that's all they could afford for their honeymoon. And my mom was reading aloud to the two of them this book, Hidden Art. She says, I would define hidden art as art found in the ordinary areas of everyday life. Every person has, I believe, some talent which is unfulfilled, some hidden area of the his being, a talent which could be expressed and developed. So in this book, she speaks of us as people who are creative because we are created in the image of God. And it doesn't mean that we are all skilled artists, though some of us are, some of us could be. But we all have areas in which we can be creative and shape the environment in which we live. The the way we express ourselves with our clothing, in the decor and ambiance of our homes, our rooms, if we're living with others, our living spaces. She talks about the gift of food, preparation of beautiful meals, of putting flowers on your table, of music. This is what she says about reading together, especially as a family. She says, you are plunged into the life of the characters in the book. You identify with another moment of history, another part of the world, another person's imagination, and you exchange glances of amusement, excitement, appreciation, understanding, or you laugh aloud together. You interject comments and stop to have an exchange of views or a conversation based on the characters or the events in the book. Whether it is with small children, adults, or a group of varied ages, there are questions or thoughts that simply burst out at times as the book is shared together, and which open up opportunities for knowing each other and each other's responses and attitudes in ways which no other entertainment could ever do. Attitudes and ideas come out which might never be brought out in ordinary conversation. It gives the family a background for thinking and growing in their concepts and understanding together rather than always separately. Reading together with one person reading aloud gives a depth of sharing which is a wonderful memory as the years go on. And then she keeps speaking about how we are bound together through reading aloud with many kinds of thread. We create shared memories when we share a book together. Both the memory of the environment in which we read it, whether it's sitting on a couch in the manor living room or the front hall, curled up in bed with a child. But we also share the memories of the experiences of the characters in the books we've read. All of my children have basically memorized Beatrix Potter's books, at least the core ones. And Peter Rabbit has long been a favorite. By the time they were three, they and I could recite it over and over. I remember how fascinated Adelaide was about a year ago now when she was two, how she would say over and over to me, but his mummy said no. But his mummy said no. I never, ever had to spell out to her the lessons of obedience in that story. They didn't need the story to explain to them that the little bunny's rebellion and disregard of his mother's warning about going into Mr. McGregor's garden leads to the terror of that chase, his illness from overeating, and the loss of his clothes. But the story, along with the threat that I hope my youngest children don't understand, your father was put into a pie by Mrs. McGregor. I hope they didn't get that part. This story ends in the security of home, of being put to bed by a scolding but safe mother. Boundaries, shelter, a shared language between myself and my children, a story that affects the shape of our lives and our relationships. I want to offer some ideas around why I think that reading stories together can aid us in our desire for rich, healthy relationships with each other and in our pursuit of goodness, beauty, and truth. And then I want to give a few practical ideas about how I think we can pursue it. I can't help but bring C.S. Lewis into this lecture at this point. He has so much to say about the importance of reading in his essays, in lectures that he gave, and in some of his books, particularly The Abolition of Man, which maybe you should just go ahead and read and not listen to the rest of this lecture. But anyway, go and read it. Here's an excerpt from one of his essays, which is called An Experiment in Criticism. What then is the good of? What is even the defense for occupying our hearts with stories of what never happened and entering vicariously into feelings which we should try to avoid having in our own person? Think of Lear in the storm, raging, his terror, his madness, his sanity, moments of sanity. What is the good of fixing our inner eye earnestly on things that can never exist? Tolkien's Shire, Lothlorien. The nearest I have yet got to the answer is that we seek an enlargement of our being. We want to be more than ourselves. Each of us by nature sees the whole world from one point of view with a perspective and a selectiveness peculiar to him. We want to see with others' eyes, to imagine with other imaginations, to feel with other hearts as well as our own. We demand windows. Literature as logos, word, is a series of windows, even doors. One of the things we feel after reading a great work is, I have got out, or from another view, point of view, I have got in, pierced the shell of some other being and discovered what it is like inside. He goes on to say, the primary impulse in each of us is to maintain and aggrandize himself, the result of the fall and perhaps even the cause of the fall, becoming more than we are meant to be. The secondary impulse is to go out of the self, to correct its provincialism and heal its loneliness. In love, in virtue, in the pursuit of knowledge, and in the reception of the arts, we are doing this. So far as I can see, this is the specific good or value of literature, considered as logos. It admits us to experiences other than our own. They are not, any more than our experiences, each all equally worth having. Then he mentions our individuality, and he concludes with these words that I love so much. Literary experience heals the wound without undermining the privilege of individuality. It heals the wound of individuality without undermining the privilege of it. In reading great literature, I am become a thousand men and yet remain myself. Like the night sky in the Greek poem, I see with a myriad eyes, but it is still I who see. Here, as in worship, in love, in moral action, and in knowing, I transcend myself and am never more myself than when I do. In reading great literature, he says, I become a thousand men and yet remain myself. Think of Jane Eyre. Walk with her through the novel. Stand in her shoes and in your own as you face devastating disappointment and betrayal and as you live with the consequences of other people's messes. Agonize with her as her longings and feelings point in the direction of running away with the man that she loves who wants her so much. And yet as she grapples with her belief in a higher good, a truth that is outside of herself and has something to say about her choices and about her ultimate happiness. Read the book. Read it with friends. Debate it. Wrestle with it. See if you agree with the conclusion that Charlotte Bronte comes to. And then you or at least one of your friends should read about Charlotte Bronte, the Bronte sisters. Think about the shape of their lives and about how that shaped their novels. In reading great literature, I become a thousand men and yet am never more myself. Treasures of the Snow by Patricia St. John is a beautiful story that I can't recommend highly enough for children from sort of 7, maybe even 6 or 5, on up to adults. It's the story of a brother, a sister, and a troubled boy. Through an act of selfishness, an accident occurs and the little brother is injured seriously and the friend is blamed, the boy. The sister is filled with rage, resentment, and she struggles for many, many pages of this book with her sense of being justified by her view of this boy who is the cause of the accidents, her temptation to spread rumors about him, to blacken his name. Meanwhile, the boy is finding hope through being able to choose towards right and good, even when no one sees you or believes in you, when no one applauds those choices. It is the story of alienation, humiliation, repentance, restoration. I'm so thankful for this story, as we've reread it a number of times out of pure love for the story, but the themes go deep. And as I see my children struggling with selfishness as I struggle myself with lack of forgiveness, I'm thankful that we have this beautiful story in our family's collective memory, the thread that wraps around us, something for us to draw on. In reading great literature, I become a thousand men, and yet am never more myself. Think of the rich relationships between mole, rat, badger, toad, in The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham. Which one do you relate to most in your chapter of life? Are you mole, who knows how to work? Or rat, who knows how to play? Or toad, who has a great capacity for fun and has no idea of consequences, at least not yet? We see the joy and freedom that comes as these friends band together, care for one another, see the world through each other's eyes. I love this bit from The Wind in the Willows, which might reveal to you which character I relate to the most. Just a quick setup of the story, for those of you who don't know Wind in the Willows. Mole is a simple character, and his world consists in the underground rhythms of work and rest. But on a tantalizing spring day, he wanders up and out of his home and is befriended by the water rat, who introduces him to the river, to boats, to picnics, eventually to swimming. After a frightening encounter, which he sort of initiated with the creatures of the wild woods, Mole is longing for the safety and predictability of home, even though he is richer now in friendship, in a broader world, in the knowledge of good and evil. Badger, one of the other main characters, bids them goodbye and pushes them out from the safety of his den on the edge of the wild wood and covers it up again to camouflage it from the enemies. They found themselves standing on the very edge of the wild wood, rocks and brambles and tree roots behind them, confusedly heaped and tangled. In front, a great space of quiet fields, hemmed by lines of hedges, black on the snow. And far ahead, a glint of the familiar old river, while the wintry sun hung low and red on the horizon. The otter, as knowing all the paths, took charge of the party, and they trailed out on a beeline for the distant stile. Now that you Americans are in England, you know what stiles are. I didn't know until I grew up and came here. Well, I didn't really know. Anyway, pausing there a moment and looking back, they saw the whole mass of the wild wood, dense, menacing, compact, grimly set in vast white surroundings. Simultaneously, they turned and made swiftly for home, for firelight and the familiar things it played on, for the voice sounding cheerily outside their window of the river that they knew and trusted in all its moods that never made them afraid with any amazement. As he hurried along, eagerly anticipating the moment when he would be at home again among the things he knew and liked, the mole saw clearly that he was an animal of the tilled field and hedgerow, linked to the plowed furrow, the frequented pasture, the lane of evening lingerings, the cultivated garden plot. For others, the asperities, the stubborn endurance, or the clash of actual conflict that went with nature in the rough. He must be wise, must keep to the pleasant places in which his lines were laid and which held adventure enough, in their way, to last for a lifetime. Evocative, home, shelter, rest after our ventures out into the big wide world, growth in self-knowledge as the mole realizes who he is in relation to the world around him, recognizing the limitations within which he is able to function, to flourish even, learning contentment, to be content with the ordinary, the unspectacular but deeply good context to which he belongs. When accused of promoting unrealistic stories, C.S. Lewis, in his essay on stories, responds that he would never expect the world to be like any fairy stories. It would be far truer to say, he says, that fairyland arouses a longing for he knows not what. It stirs and troubles him to his lifelong enrichment with the dim sense of something just beyond his reach, and far from dulling or emptying the actual world, gives it a new dimension of depth. He does not despise the real world woods because he has read of enchanted woods. The reading makes all real woods a little enchanted. I love that. Indeed, it even makes the shelter of home and homecoming enchanted. He must be wise, instead of more. He must be wise and keep to the pleasant places in which his lines were laid and which held adventure enough to last for a lifetime. Another reason why I think that engaging together with good stories is important for us at any age is that I believe that stories and good books are part of ennobling us and making bearable our terrors without denying their realities. As Christians, we are committed to living as God's children in a fallen world, and therefore, we are committed to resisting and confronting radical evil. Fairy tales, says dear G.K. Chesterton, fairy tales, then, are not responsible for producing in children fear or any of the shapes of fear. Fairy tales do not give the child the idea of evil or the ugly. That is in the child already, because it is in the world already. Fairy tales do not give the child his first idea of bogey, the bogeyman. What fairy tales give the child is his first clear idea of the possible defeat of the bogeyman. The baby has known the dragon intimately ever since he first had an imagination. What fairy tales provide for him is a Saint George to kill the dragon. That's Tremendous Trifles, an essay in that collection by Chesterton. I've just discovered a wonderful author that I'm so excited to begin to read. Her name is Katherine Patterson, and some of her essays on reading are out of print, but her novels are widely available. You might have heard of The Bridge to Terabithia, Jacob Have I Loved. She wrote a wonderful article that is on the internet, which is why I have it. And she draws on Bruno Bettelheim, an Austrian-born American psychoanalyst, to explore the idea that the child who hears fairy tales is able to face the dark and wild side of his or her nature, this is Catherine's words, and to comprehend on an unconscious level the incomprehensible adult world. Moreover, the fairy tale gives the child hope that he will succeed, overcoming giants within and without, and that he will live happily ever after. So Katherine Patterson writes about the privilege great literature gives us to eavesdrop on the soul of a literary character. She alludes to Tolstoy's picture of Natasha at the ball in War and Peace. She says, "We come away from it changed reading a great novel. We come away from it changed. And just as a season with Natasha and Andre and Pierre may make us wiser and more compassionate people, a season with Heathcliff or Jude Folly of Jude the Obscure, a season with Heathcliff or Jude Folly has the power to shake us at the roots. The fake characters we read about will evaporate like the morning dew, but the real ones, the true ones, will haunt us for the rest of our days. We Christians have done a lot of preaching about sin, much of it incomprehensible, and much of it doing nothing except laying on guilt and despair. Part of this is, I believe, because rational arguments rarely convince sinners and never saves them. But the other part is that everybody talking about hell ain't been there, to paraphrase the spiritual. Unlike our Lord, we have not been able or willing to descend into hell, so our words of grace seep out bland and bloodless. Perhaps this is why the tax collectors and harlots are closer to the kingdom of heaven than we are. But for those of us who have followed Frodo on his quest, we have had a vision of the true darkness. We know that we, like him, would never have gotten up the steep slope of Mount Doom had the faithful Sam not flung us on his back and carried us up, crawling at the last. We know, too, that we never would have parted with the baneful ring of power had the piteous golem torn it from our finger and, in the effort, fallen screeching into the abyss, clutching his damned treasure and ours. When we read fiction that is true, we do not say, "There but for the grace of God go I." Rather, "Here I am." For in such writing, we recognize our naked selves with a shudder or a laugh, sometimes quite wonderfully with both. We can talk about that more maybe a bit later. I want to move on, though, to some practical considerations for why we should read out loud and how we should read aloud. The first is probably the most important point that I have to make tonight. The main takeaway, hopefully. In pursuit of good things, we must make choices. We cannot have everything. Good things do not come to us on a platter or in neat packages that we take off the shelf and then put back. If we are going to pursue goodness, beauty, and truth with our families, with our friends, we must make conscious choices. We must prioritize. We must say no to any number of good things in order to say yes to a very, very good thing. The more we raise this to a purposeful and conscious level, the more likely we will be able to follow through with something that actually shapes us and our families and our relationships. Reading aloud is not something that just happens to us, unless you're a MERS child, and then you can't get away from it. Sherry Turkle, in her book Reclaiming Conversation, she's been a huge help to me as I seek to grapple with how to seek healthy relationships and how to pursue being a flourishing human being in our current technological climate. Turkle has been studying digital culture and communication for more than 30 years, and she speaks of how we're always tuned in but not present, how we're always communicating but have sacrificed conversation for mere connection. I highly recommend both this book, Reclaiming Conversation, and Alone Together for further reading. She asks us to consider this question. Do we live deliberately? As a friend, do I live deliberately? As a family, do we live deliberately? Are there areas in which we could and maybe should be more deliberate? Turkle's prescription is to carve out sacred spaces for conversation, for shared life. She calls us to reclaim our attention for solitude, for friendship, for society. In her compelling conclusion to this book, she says these words: "Caring machines challenge our most basic notions of what it means to commit to each other. Empathy apps claim that they will tutor us back to being fully human. These proposals can bring us to the end of our forgetting. Now we have to ask if we become more human when we give our most human jobs away. It is a moment to reconsider that delegation. It is not a moment to reject technology, but a moment to find ourselves. This is our nick of time and our line to toe, to acknowledge the unintended consequences of technologies to which we are vulnerable, to respect the resilience that has always been ours. We have time to make corrections and to remember who we are, creatures of history, of deep psychology, of complex relationships, of conversations artless, risky, and face-to-face. Of conversations artless, risky, and face-to-face. And this has a lot to do with why should we read aloud together. But lest we become overly romantic and unrealistic about the call to read aloud together, I want to call this last section of my lecture Myths to Debunk. Myth number one. If I offer to read aloud, everyone will jump at the chance. No, it doesn't just happen. And sometimes with children, at least, it's like pulling teeth. Some things that help. Start small. If you're an adult thinking of reading aloud with friends, just start small. We had an experience in Sydney when Peter and I were, we had been married for a few years. We had a couple of very young children. Peter was writing a dissertation. Some friends called up. There were four of them together in a room across town, and they asked whether they could come over that night. And I looked at Peter, and we were like, yeah, but... And Peter called out to me, well, tell them that they can only come if they bring something to read to me. Well, the friend on the phone heard that, and they came with each of them stacks of books. And it was one of the most rich evenings in our friends' relationships with each other, because they just read to us what we were reading. We were so tired. And they cared for us. They gave us a gift of reading to us. And we realized we didn't read an eighth of what they wanted to read. So we planned another evening and another. And we ended up turning this into something that was a regular thing and drew more and more of our friends. But at first we just called them reading evenings. Don't pressurize yourself, though, to make a program of it. In the pursuit of goodness, beauty, and truth, we have to believe that tastes, hints of good things, go a long way. I think there's someone here who's reading in the front hall to a group of people. And that's so precious. What a gift, probably to her, probably to the rest of you. For families, there's some things that help. Create a winsome routine. Start young. The routines may have to change through the years. Stay flexible, but also work hard to form habits, to create an atmosphere that will be consistent. It will pay off, and you will be the richer for every book that you add to your collective family memory of reading aloud. One example is this book, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. I went to sleep with gum in my mouth, and now there's gum in my hair. And when I got out of bed this morning, I tripped on the skateboard, and by mistake, I dropped my sweater in the sink when the water was running, and I could tell that it was going to be a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. Another book that we almost have memorized. But it helps us to bring humor into our day when everything's just going so wrong, or we're all at each other's throats. We talk about terrible, horrible, no good, very bad days. And the end conclusion, oh, he keeps saying, doesn't he, John? He keeps saying, I think I'll move to Australia. It was a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. I think next week, I said, I'm going to Australia. And then the closing line is, Mom Day says some days are like that, even in Australia. Another practical suggestion under this myth of how much everyone will love it if I offer to read aloud to them, keep a few books by your bedside table for the children's sake, this gem of a book, Read Aloud Family, something that will encourage you, that will remind you of what you've just lost sight of because you've just had such a hard day, or because you thought it was such a great idea to have kids, or to try to have friends because you just had a whole series of terrible, horrible, no good, very bad days. And experiences terrible, horrible ones of trying to create Shari Turkle's sacred spaces, and instead of ended up with sucky spaces that nobody wants to revisit at all. So a little bit of re-envisioning goes a long way in helping you to keep your sanity. Yes, I am a busy young mother, so I know a bit about this. A side note. To pursue beauty, goodness, and truth as a family means letting go of perfectionism while not letting go of that goal, of a goal. This requires an increasing level of resilience and courage. Kids get restless. They have bad attitudes. You have bad attitudes. And then you have the late night conversation snuggled in bed where you realize that they were listening after all. And that they grasped something that brings tears of hope to your eyes. So let go of the perfectionism. Realize that life is messy. I'm messy. Our family is messy. Our relationships are messy. But there's glimpses, glimmers, and they're valuable. They're gems. And hopefully they'll stick. Another myth. If you want reading aloud to make a difference, you will need to do a lot of it. This myth is directly from this book called The Read Aloud Family that just came out a few months ago by Sarah McKinsey, that has a great list in the back. The last section of the book is a book list that includes a lot of books that have been written in the last few years that are part of some of the older lists. So this myth is stolen directly from her book, which I also stole the idea of myths to debunk about reading aloud. She says, if you want to read aloud to make a difference, you will need to do a lot of it. Myth. I, Dawn Mers, want to read aloud to our children for hours every week. We often do, but then things happen, life happens, summer happens, whatever. And so I found that this reminder of some simple maths is helpful. If you read for 10 minutes, just 10 minutes every day, you will have read with your kids for 60 hours over the course of the year. Even if you read for 10 minutes every other day, that's 30 hours of reading over the course of a year. That's the entire Chronicles of Narnia, 1 year. That's several Jane Austen novels. That's over 200 picture books. It all adds up. Another McKinsey stolen myth. My kids should be sitting down peacefully while I read aloud to them. This is debunking the blissful picture of a large family gathered around the fireplace, quietly cozied up while one parent reads aloud and the little children drift off to sleep under blankets. Myth. Again, this does sometimes happen, and it's beautiful when it does. But realistically speaking, we have Lego, drawing, handwork, and yes, gymnastics that help our children to have an environment in which they can listen better. Sometimes we need to be engaged with our hands, with our bodies, in order to listen well. Sometimes they're just not ready for a reading session. They're still too wound up, still too excited. Stick them back in the bath or something. It's true for children that they need sometimes things to do with their hands, that they need a certain area in which they can just move around. It's also true for us as adults. We're not great listeners, most of us. Let's be honest about it. If you're an adult who wants to listen well, and I'm serious, take up whittling, coloring, knitting. It will help you. One little side note, there was a time when we were listening to a history book called The Story of the World by Susan Weisbauer. And the kids were just kind of mulling around, and it was on this audiobook, and it was all happening. And I asked, after we had finished listening to it, and it had been on for about an hour, I asked Ned to retell it to me, to narrate it back. And I just had this picture in my mind, and it's a glorious picture. He was going from the side table to the arm of the chair, 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 to the table, back to the arm of the chair. He was going back and forth across the whole room, retelling me in almost perfect detail what he had just heard, back and forth and back and forth. If I had had him sit down with his hands in his lap to retell me, I would have gotten three sentences. And if I had made him sit and listen to that, it would have probably lasted 10 minutes. Sometimes they're absorbing things we don't know and we aren't aware of. We have to trust that. Another myth. I have to be a good reader in order to read aloud. Some of us can't read out loud. Our reading level makes us insecure. Maybe we'll be reading in a second language if we read out loud in our second language. Fine. Discover audiobooks together. Organize reading times and get someone else to read. Invite someone. But most of us are mainly self-conscious. Reading aloud doesn't come naturally to most of us. It's a learned skill. Take risks. Remember to read slowly. Add just one character's voice. Have fun with it. As you grow in confidence, add more. Read as a group. Get several copies of a book and assign out a few characters. I remember reading aloud once a big fat book called Galina. She was the wife of Rostropovich, the Russian cellist. She was an opera singer. And I was reading out loud this book, and I was struggling so much because I was quite insecure. And they were all Russian names. And I stumbled so much. But it's a 450, 500-page biography. By the time I was halfway through, they were flowing off my lips. I was getting good at Russian, I thought. Well, I mean Russian names. And so we learn. We can practice. Take risks. Be willing to be vulnerable. Be willing not to be perfect. Be willing to just give it a go. Another myth. Every book people claim is a good book should be enjoyed by me and those I'm reading with, or else something is wrong with us. Myth. Do your research well. Use trusted book lists. Look it up on the internet. Research the book that you want to read. Listen to friends. Have enough knowledge behind your choice of a read aloud that you can be fairly confident of the experiment. And then just start. Give it a go. Give it a try. Give it a fair go. Don't stop right away if it doesn't grab you. But then, if it isn't working, if it isn't grabbing your imagination, if your listener's attention is just not really there, set it aside. Find another one. We all have unique palettes. Don't worry about it. Try again. Duds happen to every reader. They happen to every family. I have a book that I've been about a third of the way through for about 20 years now, and I won't tell you which one it is because it's one of those classics that I definitely should have read, and I kind of nod along when people talk about how good it is because I know how good the first third of it is. I know the students are going to be trying the rest of the term to find out what book that is. Another myth. When given the choice between Netflix, a computer game, and a reading aloud opportunity, my children will, of course, choose the healthy relational option. Myth. Books should never be set against computer time. This goes back to our family choices and creating sacred spaces. Work hard to set boundaries that will allow contentment with limitations. Set aside time and space that isn't competing with something else. They don't need to be competing, and it will just breed resentment or breed contentment, depending on how you frame it, how you organize yourself. Maybe we can add more myths to our reading aloud list, more myths of reading aloud to my list later. You all probably have some ideas. But I have one final thought about why we should read aloud, and then we'll have a discussion. Why read aloud? Essentially, because it's an act of love. We read aloud because it's a gift of love to other people to give them time and space to be present with each other. We read out loud often to children, to the elderly, to the ill. It's an act of love to bring ourselves to the level of the person whom we are with. When the child on my lap wants the same book over and over and over again, we read to them because they love the sound of our voice and they love the story and they don't need constant change. That will come soon enough. Love your children enough to read to them and to give them the comfort of your complete presence. Commit to leaving your phone out of the room and not answering the door. Read what people want to hear. Think of them. But also read what you love. Share with others. Also, reading aloud, receiving someone reading aloud to you is an act of care as well. It's giving that person the ability and the time to reach out to you, to give something to you. This is important. The act of inviting someone to share something is a risky act. Love one another enough to share something of ourselves and to invite them to something that is quite personal. It's about me, about you, us being connected with each other. To quiet ourselves enough to be in each other's presence, to make that choice. Susan Schaefer McCauley said something years ago that has stuck with me and shaped me. She said that one of the things that when we are old, we will never regret is the time that we give to those close to us, to love and to care for each other, especially our children. She was careful to say that she is speaking both to singles, to families, to elderly, to the very young. Give the gift of being present with each other, of carving out spaces, of pursuing goodness, beauty, and truth in the context of relationships. In closing, I want to share a quote from one of our family's favorite authors, a current author, Andrew Peterson. He wrote The Wingfeather Saga, and JoJo has listened to it over and over and over again, and the boys as well. Peter's reading them aloud. Andrew Peterson said, "If you want a child to know the truth, tell them the truth. If you want your children to love the truth, tell them a story." May that be true of all of us, not just our children. If we want to know the truth, tell ourselves the truth. If we want to love the truth, tell a story. Read a story. May we grow to love the truth as we love and care for each other and read stories that engage our hearts, our desires, our motivations, our will, our longings, our affections, our loves. That's what I have to share with you tonight. I would love to hear what feedback you guys have, what ideas you have, what you'd like to share from this vast amount of experience with reading that I see in front of me. Yes.
Well, it's funny that Jesus talked to us in parables.
He did.
He
did. He told us stories. He told us stories. That's right. Yeah, thank you. Yes.
Do you get any of your children to read to all of you, or is it always you?
It's both. It's both. That it tends to be, because they aren't such prolific readers right now, that they read to, the older ones read to the younger siblings, picture books. And that's wonderful. It's a real gift, and it's excellent for their reading because they get that affirmation from their younger siblings. It can sometimes go wrong, because younger siblings sometimes just don't care to stay to the end of the book or whatever. But it's often lovely. What about you? Did you have that with your kids? Have them read to each other ever? Or?
They're pretty old by now.
I know, I know.
But we do reach our granddaughter.
Yeah. Gail.
Is watching the television a very unworthy alternative to reading?
It's an activity we can do, definitely. It's not, I would say, watching television isn't an unworthy alternative. No, it's part of our reality. It's part of pursuing entertainment sometimes, enjoying something as an individual. Or something, sometimes even together, watching something together, watching a movie, watching something. That it's important to acknowledge that there's all sorts of things that can bring enjoyment and entertainment. But in terms of building something in which we, if we're with wanting to share something with a group of people, oftentimes to sit passively in front of something doesn't allow the kind of engagement with ideas. Although you can, if you all have watched a program on Saturday night, you might end up talking about it on Monday at work or whatever. But what are your thoughts? Do you have?
Well, I live alone and I always watch the telly when I'm eating.
Of course.
Because you can't read a book and feed yourself.
That's true. And you probably almost have relationships or back and forth with the regular programs that you watch.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I'm afraid of my ancient age, I tend to go to sleep when I start reading.
Yeah, it's not just you. My children know what it sounds like when I start to become more and more slow in my reading, and they are hitting my arm. Wake up, Mom! Wake up! You're falling asleep again! Other comments? Yes, Emma. I think that's a good question. I think it's a question I'm interested in other people's responses to that. My initial response, and I also had thought about this a lot because we listen to a lot of audiobooks as a family as well, is that it can be an activity that you do in isolation, just you, and that's the same as reading a book on your own. But it helps because it takes you into the role of a listener. You don't have to work on decoding the language. The vocabulary washes over you, and you can actually probably read at a higher level, understand things at a higher level than if you were reading and sort of stumbled along. So I think audiobooks are a wonderful richness, a wonderful gift. We listen to a lot of audiobooks together as a family. We listen in the car all the time. What you're missing is some of the what is lacking in listening to an audiobook is that ability to stop, to sort of say, oh, what do you think? What was that just happened? Or, you know, you're more passive together in listening to an audiobook, or you have to make, like, you know, you have to stop it and talk about it. It's a little bit. But my children sometimes say they wish I was an audiobook because you listen to an audiobook for an hour and you get an hour's worth of audiobooks. You listen to me read for an hour and I've left several times to go and take care of something or to make myself a cup of tea, you know, and they love the fact that if you have to use the toilet, you push pause on an audiobook, you run and do your business and you come back and it just keeps going. Whereas there's the more of a stop start. And more distractions sometimes, depending on the environment. What do you think, though? I'm interested. What is your experience of audiobooks? Does anyone have any strong opinions on what some of the pros and some of the more negatives would be? William?
Well, I think the audiobooks take away your inner voice and they take away your imagination because it's all laid out there. So you can't really, get lost in the book.
I wonder if that's true, that audiobooks take away your inner voice.
It depends on how you started. I started with books, obviously.
Yes.
And then when later on audiobooks came,
yes,
I found that my ability to get across in the books was getting diminished.
Yes.
So when I first read the Chronicles of Narnia,
yes,
I wasn't reading the Chronicles, I was inside.
Right. Although the book was in front of you, but you became absorbed in it. Yeah. So for you, reading something that's in front of you allows you to sort of become absorbed in it. Whereas when you're listening to it, it's too passive. There's something in you that's helpful, Deirdre.
I think there's something fascinating about actually listening to somebody and watching them. Recreate characters with facial expressions, gestures, and reading to children, their attention span goes after a bit, but they just focus on the reader. And there's a story in our family where this gentleman on my left is an old boy sitting on his father's knee having a terrible telling off. And his father said, "Well, what have you got to say?" He said, "Your mouth smells of coffee." He wasn't really listening, but he was, absorbing
something. Hannah, and then...
I had a few thoughts to that. I was to say, I'm really grateful for audiobooks myself.
Yeah.
My ideals 15 and a half years ago was so high.
Yes.
As a mum, I would read every night. And actually, Philip would read every night. And he's busy, he's teaching all things at home to, six. The reality of our lives is there are five children and we take turns. And the whole thing is a sort of messy hodgepodge most of the time. And, but I would hate it if it was just audiobooks because it forces me, if I'm reading, it forces me to sit down and read.
Yes.
And it gives me so much when I do that. Every time I do it, I think, why don't I do this more? Because I needed that. I needed that space too. But I just feel like I'm so grateful for both because it does take the pressure off me.
Absolutely.
I know they're hearing something.
Yes.
And maybe they're hearing it again and again as well, and they love it.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for that. In the back. Yes.
I'm similar that with an audiobook, I don't feel that love relationship.
Yes.
But when I sit and read with someone, that love relationship comes alive.
Yes. Yeah, thank you, John.
In your view, is there a difference between reading and storytelling?
Oh, interesting. Is there a difference between reading and storytelling? I think storytelling is that extra element of personal. So reading is taking something that someone else has given to us, a book that we've chosen maybe together, and reading it together. Storytelling, at least my experience of having someone tell me a story, is deeply personal. That person knows that story well enough and has figured out a way that they want to convey it to me or is making it up on the spot and is being creative. I think storytelling is a real gift to develop and to give to each other. I'm interested in the way that we now have so much possibility of reading and books and being able to encounter story through so many different means, audiobooks, so many different things, movies, television programs, so many ways of... But it used to be that storytelling was the main way of passing on the stories that were important to us. Very few things were written, and storytelling is such a gift. Do you have anything to say to that? What are your thoughts?
No, it's just thinking, I struggled as a poor reader for a long time.
Yeah.
But the privilege of reading to my own kids helped me to be a better reader. But what I did enjoy doing at school was storytelling.
Yeah, what a gift.
And just at the end of the day, I would just, an idea would come into my head and I would just expand it.
But I
was a pain because I would suddenly stop it at a critical moment.
You're a gifted storyteller.
And then the old Charlotte Mason, the next time, they had to narrate back the stories thus far.
Brilliant.
Because I basically
you'd forgotten.
Created.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Wonderful. Thank you. Yes.
How do you transition from reading to children what you enjoy to letting them develop their own reading? I'm just thinking, I might have enjoyed, say, Winnie the Pooh or something like that. Maybe it passed it on as a childhood memory. But in my own growing up, I quickly moved away from stories and fiction to non-fiction. I was much more interested in non-fiction.
Yeah.
The thing, I remember my father buying a set of encyclopedias when I was quite young. I really found that much more interesting as stories. But that's something I did on my own.
Yes.
But, and even with stories, you know, how do you introduce other, apart from your own preferences?
Yes.
Kids aren't the same as the other. They have their own lives to discover.
Yes. That's where I think it becomes an increasing back and forth, doesn't it? An increasing discussion. And what our children, as they become teenagers, as they become adults, what they're interested in changes from our personal interests. And that's where the discussion, if especially you've laid a good foundation, or if you want to continue a discussion, even if you haven't done it so far, where you offer a space in which you can have a discussion about that, where they bring something and you read it together because you're interested in what they're interested in reading. Maybe it's an article from the newspaper that you end up reading together and talking about. Maybe it's an essay that they just have read that they want to, or you show an interest in it and you decide to read it together. I think that's just as important to an element of shared reading that can go on, and that's part of us really learning to care for each other, is developing an interest, and it needs to go both ways. And in fact, our role as parents shifts very substantially to where we then become the listener, or we become the one who's wanting to learn from our children and hear from our children as they grow older.
Mm. I mean, one thing that you can was reading scripture.
Absolutely.
That's something that carries on. In fact, you know, my wife and I still do this at our age together.
Yes.
You know, and the children stopped doing it with us. They sort of do their own. That is lifelong, really.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's so important. And to read the scripture in such a way that you are open to discussing it together, thinking about it together, letting it impact, not letting the familiar breed contempt. But it's very important. Thank you for that reminder. Yes?
Sometimes it's also interesting to hear a story that you're familiar with being retold from a different perspective.
Yes.
Linguistically, but as in the story of the three little pigs, to hear the true story from the wolf's perspective.
I wish that I could invite you to come and be a storyteller right now and share that with us. That's great. Absolutely. Yes, Andy and then Lindsay.
It was my hand first.
Yes, I saw that.
What do you say to people who don't like to read, and can you learn to like to read?
Yes, do you mean who don't like books? Or who don't like to read aloud? Is
books in general.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of us who don't like books increasingly just because we don't grow up with so many books. Maybe we're used to movies, to the telly being on, to books being a part of school, books being part of the work that we do, our studies, and then to relax, books isn't what we would turn to necessarily. I think that's where the invitation needs to be laid out and where you need to be willing to take the risk of trying something and maybe liking it or maybe not liking it. Starting small is good, to not try to read a novel when maybe you should just start with a short story. Maybe you should just start with something that's familiar enough to you. Maybe reading graphic novels, maybe reading something that is already a part of your common language that you would have with some other person. Sometimes I think being given the gift of an environment in which maybe you try something that you haven't tried before in terms of books is important. So for instance, one of the things we do here at Libri sometimes is, I know for Edith's high tea, sometimes she'll get a few copies of The Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe or one of Lewis's books or Charlotte's Web or something like that, and just hand out a few parts to people and just have a time of reading together, but having different people be different voices, having someone be Wilbur the pig, having someone be Charlotte, and having the goose. Maybe it's just four people, and so you divvy out those parts. And it kind of makes it almost more of a play at that point than a book. And you might start to hear a story in a different way. Andy, can you feed back on that? Do you have any further thoughts?
Yeah, I think the idea of an invitation is a good answer.
Yeah. And again, I think taking risks is an important part of this, because it might be that you invite a friend to read something with you and it's a flop. You actually don't have fun together. It isn't a lovely thing. And to not just be discouraged, because that was something that happened, but to sort of think, okay, I will never try to read a G.K. Chesterton person essay out loud again. I might try an article from the Daily Telegraph, a review, and read that with somebody and then think about it. It's a movie that we both watched, then we read the review and we think about it. Something like that, to practice reading something together, to try to give ourselves contexts in which we can have conversations that are about something that we've shared, a common language that we develop between ourselves. Lindsay?
Yeah, I was wondering if you could talk about how, specifically with children, to chart a course in the darkness that we find in fiction. You mentioned fairy tales earlier.
Yeah.
The essay that you were reading and nursery rhymes.
Yes.
Bags in terms of, just they're complicated, aren't they? So
they are. That is such a good question, and such an important thing as parents of children to be thinking about. Just my current dilemma now is having someone who's 10 and a half, 11, and trying to think about what are the things that are appropriate for her at this age in terms of stories that deal with much darker things, but that are real and that are things that she will be encountering, things that death of main characters in stories. That's, I don't think, something that's too appropriate under the age of 7 or 8, at least that age. It depends on how it's depicted. I think this is where, as a parent, knowing your child is very important, and also knowing, as a parent, having good resources at your fingertips is important. So I have about 5 books that have book lists that have good age-appropriate books. And I'm quite careful to stick to those. I think it's important as well to know how the resilience of your children. For instance, when I was young, I read Old Yeller, Where the Red Fern Grows, Bambi, and a variety of others. And with my oldest daughter, who's an animal lover, I've protected her from those books until maybe this year. Because for her, to have an animal die is just as significant as to have a parent die. But then at the same time, we read when they were 5, 6, 7 years old, The Little Princess, in which the father dies. And she's left an orphan in the book. But it's how it's handled in the book. It's the way to which it's communicated and the way in which it's held. And so part of it is knowing the book, knowing the stories. Part of it is knowing what your child can handle as a person. And part of it is getting help from others and knowing what they should handle, be able to handle at that point. As a parent, it is so helpful to surround yourself with the advice of other parents, and especially with the advice of parents who have gone before you. And so I am always getting ideas from people. And there is a really great website called the Read Aloud Revival that has really beautifully laid out reading lists for families and children, and gives you a good understanding of what's in books. I also use Common Sense Media a lot, all the time, before my children watch a movie, because I can't always read everything before they read it or watch everything. And Common Sense Media is very helpful in finding out, oh, this is a book, it's a young adult book for a child and I haven't read it. What are the main themes in it? What are the things? What are some parent reviews? And that sort of thing is very helpful. Hannah, do you have something to say?
Sometimes the ideology of a book can be something that we need discussion of. I found with my daughter, who's 15 now, that when she was sort of, I guess, 11, 12, there's a lot of books marketed to that age group of girls that raise a lot of issues that I knew she had not even thought of and was definitely not.
Yeah.
They weren't going to help her to come across at that point, but now she would choose a lot of those books, and she actually enjoys these dysfunctional lives that she's reading about because she can step back from it. At the age that it was actually aimed at, for her, it wouldn't have been appropriate.
Yeah.
So just being with her in the library
was really
important. Now she'd choose for herself because she's very discerning. I know she's a very discerning person. But I'd also say in my family, one thing I've noticed happening is that the kids will say to me, well, that's not okay for Reuben, like he's 6. And they'll say, no, he can't read that. Or they'll tell him, that's not okay for you. Or to Martha, you can't read that.
Mm.
They say to me, I think he's this age for this. You know, doing it as well.
Yes.
It's not all down to us. They've picked up this idea that, you know, just because something's there, we don't necessarily take it. But there also will be errors. I think it's also important to be forgiving of ourselves and above all else, to be having conversations and to be saying, you know, look, talk to me.
Yeah, that's right.
Keep talking about what they're absorbing from all sources. Books, but from everything.
Absolutely.
So at least it's shared.
Yeah.
Wherever possible.
Yeah. Joel.
But yeah, just on that topic, it's just interesting. Our oldest is only 3.5, so we're much further behind. But I found it interesting that in a lot of categories that I've thought, or we haven't introduced to him, we've almost always been beaten by the world. Somebody will introduce them to it. So it's a tricky thing because he's in life. We're not ready yet. He is being introduced to, I remember when he was introduced to just the idea of monsters, and it was just a friend. Kids tell stories all the time. So it was interesting that we can do that, yet they're going to, he said, what source? A lot of times it is telling from their peers or someone just older. Realizing that we are equipping, by doing it with them, be able to have a conversation. You're able to at least talk about it then.
Yeah, that's right. And he's only 3.5. Yes.
I don't want to be negative, but I was thinking of all the wonderful blessings that you bestowed upon your children. No doubt this will all spread to everybody else. But you read in the newspapers that children who go to school age 5,
yeah,
and they don't even talk, so their parents have never even talked to them.
Absolutely.
Wow, what could we do for that, you know?
Yeah. Absolutely. No, there's a real heartache there, and a sense of longing for both our own children, because that's the world in which they're growing up in, even though their home environment could perhaps be something slightly more intact. But a lot of our children, their friends come from fragmented homes. They don't have a bedtime story. They don't even have, you know, maybe something apparent at home some evenings. It's not easy. I think that it's important for us to model for our children how to engage with other people, because they're going to need to learn how to grapple with people who maybe don't listen well. Or maybe to have friends who actually don't know how to have a conversation around ideas or around analyzing the movie that we just went and saw. And you want to teach your children to be gracious and understanding. But I think the more that we pursue these virtues of goodness and beauty and truth, and the more that we have a taste for them, the more we can have empathy and compassion for the people around us, but also be able to put ourselves in their shoes, because we've learned to do that in our family context, hopefully. Not perfectly, but I think there's going to need to be a lot of that that we try to do, that we seek to do, of really listening to people, because underneath the fact that they're not attracted to stories, perhaps, is the fact that they are a story. They have a story. They're interested in stories because life is a story. And to figure out how to sort of bring that out and how to invite them to something. And I think it's important, too, as our children's friends come into our homes and things, that they both feel very welcomed, but also maybe notice that there's a difference, that maybe at the dinner table everyone doesn't have out their phones, or that maybe we do have hours that our computer needs to be shut off, or a limited period of time or something like that. And it might seem very different and even distasteful, but it's something, and it's something that will provoke conversation. Let me close with a psalm that I love and a verse that I love very much. It's Psalm 34. It's a poem, and it's in the Hebrew language, it's a poem where every line starts with a different letter of the alphabet. So think of this as a poem, but I'll just read a few verses. I sought the Lord, and he answered me, and he delivered me from all my fears. Those who look to him are radiant, and their faces shall never be ashamed. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him from all his troubles. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that takes refuge in him. Come, O children, listen to me, and I will teach you the fear of the Lord. The verse I especially want to leave us with tonight is, O taste and see that the Lord is good. And it's that I think is our longing, our desire, that we would be able to taste and see, that maybe we would be provoked in some way towards tasting something that is real, something that is good, something that points towards truth, something that stirs up hope for eternal things inside us, and that we would find the blessing, and those that we love would find the blessing that comes with finding our refuge and our hope in God. Thank you so much, all of you. I have a bunch of books up here if you're interested in coming and browsing. I have a number of short stories that would be good read-alouds too.